Amen. Thank you so much. Really appreciate those words, Brother Jerry. And welcome to everyone. It is Friday, September 28th, and we are continuing our study in Volume 3. We are in Study 2, The Time of the End. And actually, last time we considered up through verse 45, which is all the verses, but we had skipped a couple verses, 29 and 30, so we're going to go back and revisit those and tie those in. And then we'll have some summary if we get that far tonight. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. We're on page 46, and we're down to the third paragraph on that page. The questions are, as we go back and revisit the earlier reference to the time appointed, what does it mean in verse 29? It shall not be as the former or the latter. What do those words tell us? And then the other question on this one is, how do we know the ships of Shittim, or maybe that should be pronounced Kittim, are referring to Admiral Nelson's fleet? So let's go ahead and if there's any initial thoughts, we'll take any thoughts. If not, we'll go ahead and read those two paragraphs and then continue on. Oh, welcome, Sister Ellie. Good to have you here. And Brother David Dominski, your mic is unmuted. You may want to mute that.
Excuse me.
All right, let's go ahead and read those two paragraphs. Got to check something here, just a second. Brother Tom Adams, I'm going to have you read first tonight. I'll have you read both paragraphs. First one's not too long. It starts as verse 40 declares. And over to you, Brother Tom.
Well, I turned the page. I'm sorry. I'm starting on 46. And it's down at the bottom of my page. As verse 40, let me turn the mic a little bit here. As verse 40 declares that the invasion of Egypt would be at the time of the end, in quotes. Or as Douay version renders it, at the time prefixed, so do verses 29 and 30, which refer to the same event and which were previously introduced as a parenthesis. It will be remembered that we have found verses 25 to 28 to refer to a previous invasion of Egypt, and in verses 29 and 30, it is intimated that the next great invasion of Egypt would be, in quotes, at the time appointed. That is, at the time of the end, in quotes. As described in verses 40 to 45. Was there an asterisk there? I see a footnote. I don't know where that goes to. Anyway, it said Willard's Universal History, page 446. Was that it? Over.
Go ahead, Brother Tom, and read the next paragraph as well.
Very good. We'll try. For me, it's at the very top of page 47 in the old Dawn volumes. At the time appointed, this is all scripture quote, at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter, end quote. Invasions, latter invasions. Okay, Napoleon's invasion of Egypt did not result either like that in the days of Cleopatra or like that in the days of her descendant, Queen Zenobia. Napoleon, though successful as a general in Egypt, achieves no such victories as his predecessors And the reason is described in this next verse. For the ships of Chittim of the Romans, as Douay puts it, shall come against him. The English Navy harassed Napoleon and hindered his conquest, since England, as well as France, had been a part of the old Roman Empire, and since France was at war with the remainder of that empire, endeavoring to conquer it, we see the propriety of these being called Roman ships. Therefore he, this is a scripture quote again, therefore he, in brackets Napoleon, shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant, and he shall succeed. End quote. End of paragraph. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Tom. And so questions are, as we revisit these references to the time appointed that we skipped over because it was treated as a parenthesis, what does it mean, it shall not be as the former or the latter? Yes, Barry, we see your hand. Go ahead, over to you.
One, two, three. Well, Brother Russell puts a very interesting, once you know the context, he puts a very interesting setting here. He says that not in the former, like in the days of Cleopatra, when Rome dominated actually Egypt, nor in the subsequent, or the 29th verse, as the former, or as the latter, or next or later, Queen Zenobia. These were times that foreign countries had dominated Egypt. But in the latter days, something would come against Egypt again. He says, not as those two things that we had mentioned, but, would come against Egypt to basically overpower and overrun Napoleon, who happened to be there, and conquer his ships. But I think the former and the latter, it seems to be the Cleopatra and Queen Zenobia, which we had discussed before. Over.
Okay, thank you. Very clear explanation. So, and this is why it was treated as a parenthesis, because we were just discussing invasions of Egypt, but he says there's going to be another one. Now, it's not going to be like the two that we've discussed so far, but there will be another one, and this will mark the time appointed. Okay, the second of three trips to Egypt. And Brother Tom Canal puts 1130 from, that must be the Douay translation, and the galleys and the Romans shall come upon him, and he shall be struck and shall return and shall have indignation against the covenant and the sanctuary, and he shall succeed, and he shall return and shall devise against them that have forsaken the covenant. The galleys there are referring to a type of ship. Yes, Brother Tony, we see your hand. Go ahead.
I think Brother Thomas there is referring to when the Douay version, I think you said it was, when he's talking about the galleys and the Romans, I think he's talking about the Chittim or Chittim, which is, when I checked it up in the concordance, and in fact I'm just going to go there now because I've just forgotten exactly what it said. Verse 30, Chittim, just give me 1 second. It's actually taken from Strong's H3794, which denotes Cyprus, it says. It was quite interested me, that, Cyprus. And it's pronounced Kitty, or it's from a root word called Kitty or Cypriots. It's an island, but this island was of Greek one time and then Roman domain, just very much like the ships that are being referred to here from England and the northern parts. They were all under the Roman Empire. So they could be still referred to, from the French point of view, as still being part of the Roman Empire. Hence, I believe the word chitim is in there, meaning, as the Douay version kind of says it a bit better, I think, galleys or ships, fighting ships, line ships, I think they are, of the Roman Empire. So, and because Britain was part of the Roman Empire, I believe they're talking about the ships there that came from Britain, which would be under Nelson's domain. Over.
Okay, very good point. You bring out a couple good points here. Number one, the connection to Rome and the connection to, I think it was Malta. I might have that island name wrong. But anyway, a reference to an island, and of course, I'll leave it at that. So very good research there. Thank you, Brother Tony. And Brother Jerry, we see your hand. Go ahead.
One, two, three. I just would like to add a little bit what Tony has opened up to us there. It's interesting that Strong's says about this word that it's partial from an unused name denoting perhaps Cyprus, hence an islander in general. And then he goes on to say that is, and this is all like deduction, that is, the Greeks or Romans on the shores opposite Palestine, Chittim or Kittim. The word itself is basically an unused word or root, and then it's taken by some of the translators meaning or denoting and implying something like Cyprus or the Roman Empire. And it may be, and that's what Brother Russell picks up on as well, is that this whole Roman realm, that there's a section of the Roman Empire that overran the Napoleon portion of the empire. However, I noticed this in one other word study, Chittim or Kittim, a general term for all islanders of the Mediterranean Sea. And the second was quite interesting. It says, the descendants of Javan, the son of Japheth, and grandson of Noah. This kind of definition here would perhaps extend particularly further west to England. The island, basically England is like an island, and Javan, the sons of Japheth, being those that migrated western. So islanders and Javan seem to have some kind of extension, but the word itself is not real definitive, but this is how some have used it. So Brother Russell does point to the forces of England, but he groups it in with Rome. And but the word itself may be possibly even more specific as being an island of the family of Javan. Could I just pick up briefly on what happened with these ships? The French were caught unawares, and in that battle, the French lost over 1,750 dead, 1,750, and 1,500 wounded. The British lost 218 dead, 672 were wounded, including Admiral Nelson was wounded also there. So it was, we say this is, I guess one of the military terms is that ships were scuttled, of the French. But the ships of Kittim or Chittim may be a coded language for these, western islands of the British and seem to fit. Over.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Brother Jerry. Very good explanation. You brought out something was the island nature of England. And I wasn't going to go into a lot of detail, but it's an interesting account. There's a Wikipedia account of it. And I guess one of the French ships exploded so violently that it even damaged ships near it. It had a very violent explosion. And the English saw this coming, and they backed away. The French ships were anchored at the time, and so they didn't have a lot of maneuvering room, but the English ships were still under sail, and they tried to back away because they could see that this fire was going to get into the hold. Okay. All right. Very good. Anything further on this? I know Brother Alan had his hand up, but Brother Jerry must have touched on what he was going to say. All right. Let's go on to the next paragraph. And the questions are, what was the concordat with the Pope, and how does it fit into verse 30? And how was it a success for Napoleon? Napoleon was very anti-papacy. And so how would signing an agreement with papacy be a success? And in what other ways did Napoleon succeed? So quite a little bit of side history comes in under this verse. So go ahead and read the paragraph. And let's see. Brother Alan, maybe we'll have you read that one. Second paragraph on page 47 on his return from Egypt. Over to you.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. On his return from Egypt, Napoleon abandoned his former policy of violent opposition to papacy and signed a concordat, or agreement with the Pope, by which the Roman Catholic religion was reestablished in France. This was an action against the truth, but he seemed to see that by this policy he could best succeed in overturning the Republic and in establishing himself in power as emperor, and he did succeed. But this policy did not last long after he obtained imperial power. He soon began again to work against that system called the man of sin, as the prophecy describes in the following words, "And he, Napoleon, shall return, change about, and shall devise against them that have forsaken the covenant of the sanctuary." In other words, he began to scheme and operate against the apostate Church of Rome. In this also he succeeded. Over.
Okay, thank you. And there's the Daniel 11, 29, and 30 on the screen. Thank you, Brother Thomas. So what was this concordat with the Pope? And how does it fit into verse 30? And how is it a success for Napoleon? And we have a hand from Brother Jerry. Brother Jerry, over to you.
1, 2, 3. I think I've been talking too much. Could we take Brother Lawrence's hand first, and then I can comment afterwards, if that's okay. Over.
Let's see. Brother Lawrence does not have a microphone at the moment, but we'd like to hear from Brother Lawrence. And Brother Jerry, maybe we will go to you first, because Brother Lawrence is going to have to get his mic going. He's just a speaker right now. So we'll give him time to go through setup and do that, and we'll go ahead and take your hand, Brother Jerry.
Oh, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, I hope we can get going. When history confirms the scriptures, it's kind of exciting for me. I would like, if it's okay, just to read a few extracts from the Age of Napoleon by Will and Ariel Durant, because he touches on this very point. And so I'll just read some extracts as quickly as possible. He says, "Napoleon himself was a skeptic, concluded that social order rested ultimately in the human animal's natural and carefully cultivated fear of supernatural powers. He came to look upon the Catholic Church as the most effective instrument ever devised for the control of men and women, for their grumbling or silent habitation to economic, social, and sexual inequality than for their public obedience to divine commands uncongenial to human flesh. What a priceless support for teachers, husbands, parents, hierarchies, and kings. Napoleon concluded that the chaos and violence of the revolution had been due above all to its repudiation of the church. He resolved to restore the association of church and state as soon as he could take the fangs out, seeking every aid to his rootless rule. Napoleon decided to win the spiritual and structural support of the Catholic Church. He tried to quiet the skeptics by explaining that he'd make the church an instrument of the government in maintaining internal peace. Pope Pius VII made one concession after another, because the plan offered to end a decade of disaster for the church in France. The concordant was to govern their relations for a century. Napoleon ratified it in September, Pius VII in December. The historic document pledged the French government to recognize and finance Catholicism as the religion of the consuls and the majority of the French people. But it did not make Catholicism the state religion, and it affirmed full freedom of worship for all the French, including Protestants and Jews. No papal bull, brief or legate, no decree of a general council or national synod was to enter France without explicit permission from the government. In the last phrase here, when the emperor dispossessed Pius VII of lands that the papacy had held for 1,000 years, still more when the Pope was evicted from Rome and imprisoned and so forth. So I think he's basically saying he humbled the church, but then he realized the church had a kind of a spiritual, mystical control over people. And so he made an agreement with them, put them on the payroll of the France, still guaranteed freedom of religion, but authorized the church to calm the people, because nobody likes revolution. Over.
Okay, very good. I appreciate that summary very much, Brother Jerry. Brother Lawrence has put his hand back down, but I'd like to give him another chance to add anything that he has. Brother Lawrence, over to you.
1, 2, 3. Well, I got the little jobby working, but Brother Jerry put most of it together. The gist of this whole thing is that the sixth period of the church went from Luther all the way to 1874, and it wasn't the time for the things that occurred in 1874 to occur in 1799. But 1799 was an effective end of any hope for papacy to rise up again in any effective way in its previous form. Now, later on, we could discuss these things about Hitler and World War II and many other things. But he never had the power. Pope had never had the power to crown and uncrown kings or emperors or anything else after Napoleon got through with him. Napoleon made sure of it. I don't think anyone realizes the ability of Napoleon as a writer of agreements and documents. He would be the attorney par excellence, and he made the Pope sign things that the Pope didn't want to sign. The Pope virtually gave away everything just to save his neck and get a few square feet in Rome and look like a fool doing it. Truly humbled. Napoleon truly humbled that institution. It's never recovered from it. And it's a terrible mess today. If you look around the world, where the Catholic Church still operates, look at the kind of people they have put in leadership roles. It's nothing like it was before. It's just the place is empty. I went back and read a couple of treatises this afternoon, or just scanned through them, and they were very blunt about it, how sad a situation the Pope found himself thereafter, and the Church has found itself there, in every land in the world. Very sad. But anyway, we don't care much about all this going down of the old order or how it's going down so much as we are looking for the eventual resurrection of the ancient worthies who will bring real leadership in the seats of power. And if you only had one of these fellows with power and advice and the power to overrule any actions that were taken by existing leaders, it would make the world a different place to live in. So, dear brethren, I realize that you're not going to see all the overview of all this in an understandable way, maybe from our study of the volume. But as you piece together the writings of modern writers who understand this so thoroughly and have elaborated in book after book after book after book of the true situation of society today, then you can put this together and get a picture of what was before and what passed away. And there was some rising up for a time, but it also passed away. And now they're in desperate conditions, and the whole world is in desperate conditions. And I think we're closer to the end than many would like to think, maybe, or maybe it's not the other way around. But nevertheless, in God's due time, this thing is going to occur almost precisely the way Brother Russell just stated it here in the Volume 3, Volume 4, and his writings after 1914, and the forewords, etc. It's a marvelous piece of work. And it gives us wisdom beyond belief that we should feel sorry for the poor world of mankind that go to the universities and get their heads filled with mush and nonsense and come out with almost minds incapable of reason or logic or common good sense. Well, thank you, brethren, for listening. Over.
Thank you very much, Brother Lawrence. That's some very good insight there, and you've touched upon this summary question that's coming up here, and looking back on the chapter, The Time of the End, it really is a masterpiece, and so insightful overview of history. Okay, Brother Tony, your hand is next. Over to you.
I was, when I was reading this, I was quite amazed at how quickly I'd kind of lost the stream of time in what's happening here. There's so much happening so fast, it makes it look like it's in slow motion, our government and what's happening with us over here in America. So much happened, because if you remember, Napoleon fought against the Catholic Church. Napoleon had the Pope Pius VI, I believe, held captive and died in his captivity. And now, because, and I think we're not to forget the reason why Napoleon did this. I don't think it was because of his niceties or the love of the Church or anything like that. But he decided that because of all this change that was happening over in France and all these new countries gathering together and looking like they're going to be standing against France, he could see that he was in a spot of bother. And he decided that now would be a good time that I make an agreement with the Catholic Church again and give them some favour back. Now, we did this in 1801. So all that we've been reading about over the last few weeks took place in just a few years. It's unbelievable. He did all this in probably less time than we've been reading through this this volume. But this concordant that he did in 1801, it was to basically just give the Catholic Church the name of the main church in France. Not the Church of France, but the main church in France. But he withheld an awful lot of the privileges that they used to have. For instance, he made sure that he picked the bishops. And of course, he only picked the bishops that were more in line with his way of thinking than any other way of thinking. He also made it that the church could not control its own purse strings. He was in charge of doing that. And there was quite a lot of land changes that were made. And all this was made really so that he could try and get a greater strength in its position of wannabe, well, emperor of this new regime that he was trying to build up for. We'll learn pretty shortly that it didn't last too long. But an interesting found was that this concordance that was the early part of, no, I think midsummer, I can't remember now, of 1801, I believe it was still in force in the latter part of Pastor Russell's time. I'm not dead certain about that, but I think it went up to the 1910, 1915 time. Over.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Appreciate that comment very much and the research that you did there. And I think you kind of had a question at the end there. How long was this concordat in effect? And you know, I didn't do the research on that. So Brother Allen says the concordat of 1801 lasted till 1905, according to Wikipedia. Okay, thank you. Brother David Dominski, your hand is up. Over to you.
1, 2, 3. Well, the, in 1997, I think it was then that we made a tour of France with Brother Jerome Grun, who lived there, and while we were going around, I said, "Well, do you have a Protestant Bible?" And he said no. So he said he wanted one, and so we went into a bookstore and asked for one, and there was no Protestant Bible there, you know, like a King James Version or something of that nature. Everything is still being held in reserve there in France because of the Catholic Church being so strong, and they of course don't promote reading other things. So it just brought back my memory of those years when we were trying to find the Bible. Finally, at the third store, we were able to pick one up. Over.
Okay, that's an interesting account showing the influence of the Catholic Church in France. I think it's still very much strong influence. Okay, thank you for relating that, Brother David. I put up this one quote, it was a while back, where Napoleon said in 1801, "Skillful conquerors have not got entangled with priests. They can both contain them and use them." And I was reflecting upon the comments of Brother Jerry and Brother Lawrence, both can see the advantage that Napoleon gained from this concordat. And Brother David, your mic is unmuted.
Still there? Oh, I thought. Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
All right. And Brother Allen, we see your hand. Over to you.
One, two, three. Well, it's kind of technical details of this, but it is interesting in connection with what Brother David said. This quote from Wikipedia, the Concordat was abrogated by the law of 1905 on the separation of church and state. However, some provisions of the Concordat are still in effect in the Alsace-Lorraine region. I won't read the rest of that. But that's probably, well, I don't know, but a lot of the brethren are in that area. That's in kind of the northern part of France. So there would still be remnants of that in effect even today, which is interesting. Over.
Okay, thank you, Brother Allen. And I think I have some relatives from that area in my maternal grandfather's side. Okay. Interesting insights into this concordance. Yes, Brother Lawrence, we see your hand. Over to you.
One, two, three. Well, that phony contribution of Constantine that we're talking about in northern France that the Pope made so much to do about down through the years was strictly is phony. It was a false document. Constantine never made that contribution to anyone in his day. There was no pope to make it to. So, not like the pope that came into being thereafter. So, the fact that somebody still makes some claims along this line, I would doubt that there are folks, not many folks that have property rights in that area would be real happy to give them up and give them back to the control of the Pope so that he got the income from all those square miles of land and so forth and so forth and so forth and so forth. This is very similar to the fabricated Lord's Prayer that they use that brings in the concept of the Trinity. That was never the Jerusalem Prayer used by any of the early elders of the Jerusalem Church. So all these things are based on subterfuge to gain power that a little bit of the examination of history reveals as false. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Lawrence. Very interesting. Some real good insights are coming out here. I appreciate this. Anything else? If not, let's go to the next paragraph. And it's kind of a summary paragraph. A good time to think about what we've learned here in Daniel 11. And let's go ahead and read that paragraph. Here are the questions. In summary, how has Daniel 11 clearly achieved its purpose of establishing the beginning of the time of the end? What ended then and what began? What else has been accomplished by Daniel 11? And how did Volume 2 show the beginning of the papal millennium? Okay, let's go ahead and if there's no initial comments, we'll read that paragraph. Brother Bill or Sister Marilyn, could we have you read that paragraph for us? It starts at the bottom of page 47, thus pointedly does Daniel 11. Over to you.
One, two, three. Thus pointedly does Daniel 11 trace the world's history by its most notable characters, from the kingdom of Persia down to the overthrow of papal dominion. Though covering the long period of 2,400 years, it accomplishes its purpose of clearly marking the very year of the beginning of the time of the end, 1799. With that year terminated, the limit of papacy's 1,260 years of power to oppress and the time of the end began. And let it not be overlooked that this was also the last year of papacy's millennium, or 1,000 years reign, which began, as shown in the previous volume, that is volume 2, with the year 800. But 1799 was only the beginning of the period known as the time of the end, within the limits of which every vestige of that system shall pass away. Over.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Bill. So how has Daniel 11 clearly achieved its purpose of establishing the beginning of the time of the end? And what ended then, and what began? Yes, Brother Lawrence, we see your hand. Over to you.
One, two, three. Well, I can do this rather quickly, I think. Well, as we discussed, Napoleon lost practically all his navy down in Egypt. So, as a result of that, his efforts to go all the way to India, as one of his predecessors had, Alexander the Great, that had to go over land. So he went over land, but then he got to the big river. It may have been the Indus in India. On the other side is the Indian emperor, and he's got elephants. Napoleon doesn't have any elephants. So anyway, to make a long story short, Napoleon was on land, was outnumbered by far. So he tried to do so with subterfuge, but his plan was uncovered, which forced him to turn back. Now, I think we all know that Britain was a controlling force along about this time in India. So Napoleon had to turn around and head back on land. And when he got to Turkey, he had to take a ship, as I understand it. And that ship landed in... had to make some stops along the way, but it landed in France itself in October, November of 1799. So this fits in directly with Daniel's prophecies, to my thinking, and the historical account is so well documented and is there for us to investigate it, that it really leaves no doubt that the time of the end started not only in that year, but in the proper month of the year also. Over.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much, Brother Lawrence. So we can see how things were under control. Okay, there's the Douay-Rheims version of the 30th verse, and that's the one that says, "The galleys and the Romans shall come upon him, and he shall be struck, and shall return, and shall have indignation against the covenant of the sanctuary. And he shall succeed, he shall return, and shall devise against them that have forsaken the covenant of the sanctuary." Okay, Brother Tom Adams, we see your hand. Over to you.
Yes, just wanted to mention, someone wanted to know where I got it from. Well, of course, first mention of it was in the volume, but I thought, well, I wonder if I can find a scripture for that. And I wasn't thinking. I looked through several, and then it dawned on me that, well, I wonder if he was looking in the Douay. I didn't even know I had one. But there's a, it's called DRB, that's all. So I found, that's where I found it in verse 30. So I put it on the board to call attention to the pastor was using and looking in that Douay Bible, which I think is a Catholic Bible, if I'm not mistaken, but over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And I do believe Douay is a Catholic Bible. Okay, Napoleon lost a whole army and literally returned to France by himself. And French leaders welcomed him with outstretched arms to restore order to France. Matter of fact, they had ordered him to return. And he did not get that order, but he was returning anyway, because of the news that that he knew what was going on in France. Thank you, Brother Lawrence. Brother Jerry, we see your hand. Over to you.
Oh, 1, 2, 3. I see we're coming to the end of our time here. Just, are we on that 47, paragraph 3, I think, and the questions that are there?
Yes.
Okay. What else has been accomplished by Daniel 11, and how did the volume 2 show the beginning of the papal millennium? I found this rather interesting when I first read it. I'm just a little bit puzzled, because Brother Russell says a 1,000-year millennium beginning in 800, and my mind kept clicking back to 539, the beginning of the 1260 years. And but the 1,000 years did indeed begin with 800, because that was Charlemagne, when the French Emperor Charles, or Charlemagne, gave the papal states property to the state, to the papacy. And like Brother Lawrence says, they collected taxes and a lot of other things too. So from 800 to 1800 or 1799 was 1,000 years. Of course, it was 1260 years from 539, the ascendancy to civil power. But this 1,000 years really reached it to 1800. But something happened then. Even then, property was not removed. It was like a 1,000-year reign, and recognized, which they were indeed humbled at the end of that 1,000 years by Napoleon. But they still had the papal states for just exactly 70 more years. It was in 1870 that Victor Emmanuel, an Italian general, took all those papal states away from the papacy. And that's when they were relegated to the Vatican. They had another palace in Rome, which they still oversaw all those papal states up until 1870. So 70 years is kind of an interesting number also. 1,000 years was given until their humbling, and another 70 years given until the plug was pulled on what Charlemagne gave them in 800. So I think that the volume to chronology is a very good point on this, and that's what I was thinking about. Over.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you brought that out. That's a nice summary of how volume 2 showed the beginning of the papal millennium and how that was related to 800. Anything else? We're close enough to the end of our time. I don't think I'll tackle that next question. I'll leave that over until next time. One question is, what else has been accomplished by Daniel 11? And what I was going for there is, how does it affect us as we've reviewed this and see how history matches up with this in such a marvelous way? And what is the effect upon us? So I think our consideration of Daniel 11 has certainly increased our faith and confidence that the divine plan is unfolding. And it predicted history thousands of years in advance. Such an amazing account when you think about it. Oh, the Lawrence adds down below, the Pope forced Charlemagne to kiss his toe by crawling through the snow to receive forgiveness in 800 AD. The papal millennium was a sad millennium indeed. Yes, very true. I saw a hand from Brother Tony. Brother Tony, did you have a quick comment? Over to you.
It was just in what you were saying. As I've been going through these studies, I've often wondered, how can these events bring down the Catholic Church? And since from 1799, the Catholic Church seems to have grown in power grown in strength, grown in size, grown in authority. And I've been thinking, but in these last decade or so, especially in these last 5 years, the Catholic Church is just about to collapse. It's almost turning in on itself now. I mean, Ireland, when I used to live in England, which is like 20 years ago, but Ireland, Southern Ireland I'm talking about, was an extremely Catholic country. Very, very, very extremely Catholic. In fact, over there, in my day, no daughter could ever marry a non-Catholic. They would have been removed to a convent if they ever dreamed of doing it. It was so Catholic. In fact, the whole of the island believed the reason there was no snakes, which there isn't on the island, is because of the Catholic Church and St. Patrick. So it's absolutely... But even since then, over the last two years, even Ireland has given up the power, has overtaken the power of the Catholic Church. And now, which I would never believe would have happened, is they're permitting abortion, legally permitting abortion. Wow. And if you look at now what's happening around the world with this child pornography and child abuse, it's amazing how Daniel, so many years ago, well, I know how he did it, but it was put down, and now we're seeing it unfold in front of our very, and it's unfolding very quickly too, right in front of our eyes. I'm absolutely amazed. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that that perspective. All right. Yeah, some interesting thoughts coming out on the screen here. So our next study will be on page 48, paragraph 1. Let's go ahead and